I'm Stuart Dryberg, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock.
Howdy.
Howdy to you. Hey, it is time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Can you tell our listeners who's on the show today?
Legendary cinematographer Stuart Dryberg. Holy crap. Stuart
That's right.
Dryberg, who shot, if you haven't seen this movie, just stop listening to us right now and go see it. He shot Once Were Warriors.
Yeah, that's true. We talk about it quite a bit, actually.
He shot Portrait of a Lady. He shot Lone Star for John Sayles. He shot Aeon Flux for Karen Kusama. Look him up. I mean, like, he's got an embarrassingly rich filmography. His stuff is just amazing, and I'm super jealous you got to talk to him.
It was a great conversation, and I got to say that his most recent work that you can watch right now, which we spend a good chunk of time talking about, is the Amazon Prime TV series Fallout. So
awesome.
If you saw
Very
Fallout,
buzzy.
Yeah, that's it's got a lot of good buzz. It's
yeah.
got a lot of cool stuff in it. So we'll get into that interview in just a few minutes. But first up, Ben. What's our close focus? Anything going on in the industry this week?
And now, close focus.
Nothing really, no. It's been a slow week. I mean, like,
yeah.
you know, who cares? Oh, by the way, just, you know, slight thing. Paramount Studios was sold. But it wasn't just Paramount Studios.
Yeah, only one of the major studios just got sold to Skydance, David Ellison and his venture capital, company, which... conceivably now owns a massive swath of the mass media landscape in this country
yeah.
and around
well,
the world, you know, technically.
And it's not just Paramount. It's National Amusements, which was Sumner Redstone's company, which was being basically held for ransom by Sherry Redstone, his daughter, who saw it as her legacy. And the sale of this has been it's been a very on again off again thing for
years.
I don't know. Yeah, yeah.
Years.
It's been a minute, and they don't just have Paramount. It's like a lot of legacy stuff, and so to you and me, it's stuff that sounds relevant, maybe, mm-hmm. but to somebody under a certain age, like maybe somebody in their mid 30s or under, a lot of it's going to sound like completely irrelevant to their life, like. Nickelodeon, which was huge and I could still be huge. MTV, BET, a lot of people say BET has a lot of juice, and there was talk for a while of Tyler Perry trying to buy it and Byron Allen trying to buy BET. And there's a good chance, I think, that a lot of these legacy brands would be sold off for parts. You know, like it's debatable, you know, as a member of the MTV generation, it's highly debatable that MTV's name has value anymore, because the thing that it was best at doing, it stopped doing about, you know, 30 years ago or maybe 20 years ago.
So what David Ellison and crew, though, are saying is that they are bringing a fresher, younger, you know, voice and leadership to the organization. And so we could see a lot of changes. Now, Paramount has major franchises. CBS, of course, falls inside of this. CBS
yeah.
has a portion of the rights to the NFL, which is a huge sort of like centerpiece of the whole CBS component. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, CBS has never been the major network for youth. And so maybe that youthful direction won't change some of the properties all that much. But, you know, franchises, Paramount's got several of them, including, you know, two from Tom Cruise between
yeah.
like Mission Impossible and Top Gun.
Yep.
But of course, most famously, Star Trek.
Yep.
And Skydance brings some of their own sort of successful franchises themselves to the equation, which have been predominantly, it seems like, through an agreement with other streaming services like Netflix and Amazon. So I'm wondering if maybe Skydance Productions will no longer go to those homes. Maybe they'll come to Paramount Plus. They've already made some claims that Paramount Plus is going to get an upgrade in some ways. I don't know.
I mean,
exactly
there's been talks about
means.
Even folding Paramount Plus, I believe, in with Peacock or bundling or blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, one of the things that I've been harping on for a long time is that, you know, in the 70s, 80s, maybe even into the 90s, the entertainment industry was a sexy place where you could get rich and make a lot of money and do lots of cool stuff. And so it attracted young executive talent and you know, people in the executive wing would be on the younger side. And that's not the case anymore. Now it's big tech. So my hope is that Skydance will infuse Paramount and maybe create a ripple effect of younger people in the executive wing. So the people who are greenlighting the shows and the movies are also, you know, have a cellular level understanding of the people that they're trying to get to watch them. You know, because I think if you're an executive in your 60s thinking about what MTV was like in the 1990s or the 1980s, MTV sounds attractive, but how do you make MTV interesting to somebody today? You know, you almost have to start over. BET is a different situation because they were always relevant. But, you know, Comedy Central, you know, like I feel like Comedy Central right now is on a little bit of a buzz because they brought Jon Stewart back to The Daily Show. But again, that's not exactly a young people move. Much as I love Jon Stewart, and I do, you know, I feel like Comedy Central has been floundering. And that's, you know, the network that brought us Key and Peele and Chappelle's Show and, you know, South Park, like all of these things that were, you know, super, super hip and cool and fresh, you know,
yeah,
20 plus years ago.
Well, you know, something interesting for the sci-fi nerds out there, Skydance controls the rights to Terminator, the Terminator franchise now. And so I know that there's a Terminator series that I believe is supposed to go to Netflix later this year. But, you know, Terminator was such a huge hit, although Dark Fate, which arguably I thought was, you know, the strongest Terminator movie in years, didn't perform well at the box office pre-pandemic. But who knows? Maybe we'll see something like that coming back
I would love to see it, but I kind of feel like Terminator had like two great Terminator movies and then the rest of it was sort of...
Dark Fate is pretty incredible in that.
I liked Dark Fate. I will admit, I thought it was really cool. I just felt like
Dark Fate just
flopped.
Well, yeah, it was smart though. It basically just predisposes that those other movies that weren't so great didn't exist.
But doesn't that move piss you off a little bit? Like it pisses me off when it's like, if you're going to tell me that none of the movies existed, then I think you should refund me the ticket price for Halloween's 3 through Rob Zombie reboot.
I think it's a bold move for them to essentially say that stuff's not canon. We're moving on. And if they do that well, then great. It could be a strong franchise. There is something to be said about, you know, the overt themes of AI and class warfare that Terminator, you know, predisposes. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
I'm down for any of it, but Paramount obviously owns and controls. I mean, just Star Trek alone is like something that's really stood the test of time and stood being rebooted and retooled and futzed with and changed around. And you know, people love it, and it's a very flexible idea because you can always be like, hey, it's a different crew and a different mission, and you know, kind of make up a whole new deal.
I know a couple of Star Trek movies in development right now, including one from Andor director Toby Haynes, which is like,
nice.
could be really something. So Paramount's been strong in sci-fi for a long time. I have a feeling they'll continue to be strong in this space. But it's, you know, there's probably going to be cuts. There's probably going to be cuts. I mean, typically when venture capital backed, or I should say private equity backed, companies come in to take control over big legacy companies, they look for ways to pay for that acquisition.
I'll tell you where all the money's going, and if you live in LA, you'll know what I'm talking about. There's a giant wall on the Paramount lot that's just a sky.
That's right.
Maintaining that has been a bitch.
No, I'm sure it has not.
So, they got to touch that sucker up. They got to get bird poop off of it. It's like the blue isn't photographing blue enough.
Yeah. Definitely something to pay attention to. I don't know if it's going to be Paramount, a Skydance company, or how they're going to, if that name's how it's going to come in.
Honestly, Paramount, I got to say, has been like passed around like a pack of cigarettes forever. Remember when it was a Gulf Plus Western company?
Sure.
Like Paramount, all of these companies get owned.
All of these companies at various points.
And in fact, Rob Long on Martini Shot did a whole episode about this and about. He quoted, I believe it was The Art of War, you know, live long enough and you'll see the bodies of your enemy floating down the river. And it was talking about, you know, like the various people who've come in and bought the studios and then lost their shirts and then someone else came in. And I feel like Skydance at least has a really great chance because they're big players in the industry, regardless of Paramount. So,
yeah, 100%. All right. So, Ben, we should probably get to the interview now with Stuart Dryberg.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Stuart Dryberg. He is the cinematographer of the hit Amazon Prime television series Fallout. He also did a few other movies and television shows along the way. IMDb reminds me that he's best known for The Piano, which of course is a lovely, beautiful movie from way back when, Jane Campion movie. I think you even got a very honorable award nomination for that, but way back then.
We did Academy Award nomination and a few other bits and pieces at other places in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Stuart, thank you so much for being on the Cinematography Podcast.
You're welcome. Delighted to be here.
Hey, okay, so I guess this is my first question for you has to be is, has The Piano, I mean, look, did Jonathan Nolan and the rest of the people at Fallout go, get me the guy who shot The Piano, he's going to be perfect for Fallout? Or has this been a thing like for the entire rest of your life? Do you feel like you've been typecast a little bit when you get in? Does the shadow of The Piano, of this beautiful, very lyrical, long take, wide shot movie, does that give anyone preconceptions? You've done a lot of very different things since then, but I'm just kind of curious, if IMDb tells me that you're best known for The Piano when you have all this other stuff, they didn't say Aeon Flux, they said The Piano. So
no, and for a while there it was Bridget Jones' Diary, but I'm delighted that The Piano has moved back up to number one. The short answer is it used to. Piano was a film we made in New Zealand as a bunch of Kiwi kids with some wonderful famous American and New Zealand actors, but you know, it was biggest thing we'd ever done, and we knew it was good. We didn't know it would be as big as it was. We didn't know it would go to Cannes and then the Academy Awards, blah, 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 you know. You know, so I think it's always the way in this business. You give it your best shot, but you never know until an audience sits down and watches it whether you've succeeded or not. And we succeeded there, which was great. For me, it was my ticket out. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd done – the work I did with Jane was very – helpful in getting me work outside of New Zealand. And, you know, getting it out of New Zealand is a challenge sometimes. It's a little country and it's a long way away. And if you want to do more varied work, it's useful to be able to, you know, get out into the world. So, you know, Angel at My Table actually got me my first job with Mira Nair in the Perez family in Miami. But Piano was definitely the ticket out. And, you know, for a few years, definitely there was that sense, well, this is the 90s, remember? Ah, he plays way well with women. Mm. So we can connect, you know, and that's not a bad, so also I hope is true. But, you know, I play well with people in general, I would hope. But you know, there was this sort of sense that not all men could, and I could. And so that helped me get certain jobs. Perhaps, as you say, Aeon Flux with Karen Kusama. The pilot for Sex in the City was Susan Seidelman. I worked with, you know, a number of great woman directors over the years. And definitely sort of pushed, because of that sort of, should we say, girl-centric vibe, a lot of rom-coms. Mm. Runaway Bride, Bridget Jones' Diary, which were great projects, but not necessarily my first love in cinema. With Runaway Bride, you know, Gary Marshall said to me, Your job's very simple. Just make the girl look pretty. Julia Roberts, you know, not so hard, but, you know, that was the job, you know.
And you know, it and look, you know, I kid, of course, asking this question, but of course, I'm curious because it is a gorgeous looking movie. But you also have done plenty of stuff that's on the other side of that coin too. That's not going for that look, a grittier look, a rougher look, and you know, big budget Hollywood looks and stuff. Sort of like you know, the Men in Black. You know, Men in Black 3.
Men in Black. I would say Black Hat in that world. You know,
and very. You know, also, and I love one of your earlier films too. Once We're Warriors.
Oh my God! Yes.
Such a fantastic looking and just wonderful movie to get go. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit just about like you know, and we'll get into Fallout here in momentarily, but I'm really curious. Go from Piano to Once We're Warriors. I know it's another Kiwi movie, but you know you couldn't talk about two movies that are more aesthetically different back to back. So.
And part of that is very intentional that Lee Tamahori, who directed Once Were Warriors, who's an old mate of mine. We'd come up through the film industry together. I'd been a gaffer. He was a boom operator when I first met him. What you need to know is that Once Were Warriors was already a hugely successful novel and very influential already in New Zealand because of its subject matter, because of, you know, anyway, it was big. So Lee rang me up and said, we're going to do the movie of Once Were Warriors. You want to be in it and part of it? And I said, yeah. And he said, and my assumption was in our first conversations that we would be doing something sort of Ken Loach, British kitchen sink reality, you know?
Yeah.
And I pitched that to Lee and he went, no, that's not what we're doing. We're going to shoot this almost like a TV show, really clean. Really simple coverage, you know, and it needs to be accessible. Everyone should never look like an art movie. This should be something that everyone in every town in our country, and as it turns out, the world, can see and relate to because it's, you know, these we're ultimately talking about real people with real problems in a real world. So let's keep it real. And keep it accessible.
Definitely, you know, mission accomplished. It's a great movie. But you know, when I look over your body of work, I think that perhaps maybe my favorite movie might be one of your smallest, and that was the John Sayles movie Lone Star. I mean, it's just got such wonderful sort of film noir, high contrast, long shadows. And I mean, John Sayles is notorious for, you know, short production schedules, low budgets, making the most possible. And he gets incredible actors. And I know it's a Chris Cooper and Matthew McConaughey. And I mean, can you reminisce just a little bit?
Chris Christopherson. I mean, yeah. Chris Christopherson, for God's sake. I know. Yeah, sorry.
No, not at all. And in the back of my head, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I seem to remember like a poor man's process in it too. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, like a really great nighttime poor man's process that I was like, it was really influential for me because I was working, you know, a little bit as a camera assistant and operator and DP back then. And I was like, that is excellent poor man's process. I remember, you know, out of focus lights just sort of bouncing around a little bit in the background. And can you tell a little bit just about the Lone Star experience?
Lone Star, one thing about Lone Star is that Lone Star grows directly from Once Were Warriors.
Mm. Okay.
Because Lee, Once Were Warriors was reasonably, you know, very successful in New Zealand, did a bunch of festivals, was quite widely seen in the world and definitely got him a gig in LA. He was doing Mulholland Falls, I believe it. I'd never get the Mulholland Falls, Mulholland Drive mixed up. Gangster movie, 1930s, 40s or 50s, I think, in LA. And he called me up. He said, look, I've got this gig. Don't be offended, but I'm going to ask one of the old-time American DPs to do it. I want a hard light movie. I want that look. Mm. So he asked Haskell Wexler.
Yeah,
and Haskell said yes, right? Now, as you may know, Haskell was a longtime collaborator of John Sayles. Mm. They'd done together many movies, but my favorite of theirs together is Matewan. I just think it's the quintessential, you know, American movie, and I love it because the sheriff who is who's it plays? Not Chris Cooper. Chris Cooper plays the union organizer. But the elected sheriff of the town sides with his people against the mine company, which never happened. Well, didn't happen enough. And it was such, anyway, it's a great film. Anyway, so John's got a movie going called Lone Star. He's just got greenlit. So he calls Haskell, as you would.
Yes.
And Haskell says, oh, John, I'd love to do it, but I just took this picture with this Kiwi guy, Lee Tamahori. You know, you saw his Once Warriors at Sundance. Oh, yeah, we did. And John goes, well, what about the guy who shot that? And it was like, bam. You know, and I got a call from my agent saying, would you like to read a script from John Sayles? I said, read it. I'm just doing it. I don't care. I mean, I know the script will be brilliant. If you'll have me, I'll do it. And next thing, I was on a plane to Texas to do that. And I think, you know, like everything John does, it's dense and it's novelistic, and there's a lot of, you know, especially Lone Star, many, many characters and interweaving story threads that all resolve to tell a particular story at the end. And one of the things that that John wanted to do was that when we went into flashbacks, often when one of the characters is telling a story, we need to go travel back through time, and then at the end of it, come back to the modern day. The classic is a scene in the cantina where one of the guy who used to be a deputy sheriff and he's now the mayor or something of the town, and starts telling the story to Chris Cooper about his dad, Chris Cooper's dad. Camera pans off this guy down into a basket of tortillas on the table. And when it comes up the other side, there's Chris Christopherson as the old
in camera
bribes and bullets.
Oh, yeah.
Sheriff, right? Okay. And this was done by really simply, literally by just moving the camera. And then we had set pieces that we could move in and out so that completely mechanical. Completely mechanical. Entirely John's idea. And we did this two or three times through the movie, and it's fun. I just did a seminar in Berlin, and we talked about that with the film students a lot. There's the scene that you referenced, Celia, the poor man's process, which I think was the very last thing we shot on the very last night. And as you said, low budget film, short schedule. John very rigorous with himself. If he feels like he needs more than three takes, he feels like he's failed. Mm. And he really, you know, five would be huge.
Oh yeah.
It just doesn't do it. So we shot a lot in a day. We got a lot of great work done. But there's this scene where Chris Cooper is driving at night. He's come back from visiting his ex-wife, and he's starting to uncover the mystery of his father. And he's you know, thoughtful, and there's a very cool piece of music playing, and he's driving at night, and it's Poor Man's Process. As you said, there's this, he's just sitting in the car, camera's looking through the windscreen, we're moving a few lights, we got a little glow from the dashboard, you hear a car pass, meow, and you see the lights, woof, and then a little red glow as the taillights recede, which is all just, you know, my crew running around with lights.
Yes, exactly.
and then the thing that was really magic was we put the camera on the front of a car, I think, or maybe it was a pickup truck, at twilight, and shot like with the headlights on, just like a point of view driving up one of these desert highways in Texas where we were. And what they did in post was they then superimposed that image on the windscreen, and it's not a realistic reflection and yet it totally works. It's like, and the whole scene is so atmospheric, you know, with just one drive-by shot with this car, pickup truck or sheriff's car, I guess, is driving up to the ridgeline in twilight, and quite beautiful. It was a wonderful experience. It was a great experience to shoot that film.
I was just going to say that, like, you know, I feel like that sort of era of, like, you know, early to mid 90s was sort of like this golden age of creativity, and, you know, especially in the low budget film world, because you know, you didn't have there were really no digital intermediates. There was no digital cameras. All the technology, nope. Everything had to be done photochemically, had to be done in camera. And everything relied so much on what was happening on the day and the work of the DP in order to sell, you know, these effects, to sell these things. So, no, and the fact that, you know, John Sayles, who traditionally works at like a tiny fraction of the budgets of you know, of major studio releases, it's all to me just amazing what was coming out in that era. So, all right, so Stuart, I want to connect the dots here and get to Fallout. So, you know, sure. You've done a lot of things in between, but let's just jump forward. Do you get a call, or does your agent get a call from Jonathan Nolan? How does Fallout fall into your lap?
I'm guessing that Paul Cameron wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true. But Paul's a longtime collaborator of Jonah's. He shot the pilot and quite a lot of Westworld when required. I would have, if I was Jonathan Nolan, it would have been my first call. So for whatever reason, not happening. And somehow, and as I said, I doubt it was the piano. I doubt it was Aeon Flux. Somewhere along the line, they must have seen something I'd done that they liked. Maybe it was the Men in Black movie. But I got the call. I read some scripts, went to my first, did a Zoom meeting, as we are here, as everything is in our wonderful modern age. And I had prepped, I'd read the script, and I'd seen some playthroughs of the game. So I had some idea what the base is. So, you know, because the game has been around for 30 years. Mm. And pulled a lot of images and built a Pinterest board, which turned out to be completely wrong because I'd gone very sort of atmospheric, very gamey with my references. And Joe said, no, I don't want to do it that way. I want to play it real, just real and straight, not too many tricks. There's going to be enough crazy stuff in this movie, content-wise, without us overlaying any camera. I'm not going to say bullshit, but
but you all know what you mean.
We just, you know, play it straight.
Yeah,
you know, and just make it nice. Okay, I can do that. And you know, Jonathan, like his brother, only wants to shoot film. Mm-hmm. God bless him. God bless them both. I was just pleased that he did want to shoot it on an IMAX camera, to be honest. But he did, very clear in that first meeting, 35 millimeter, full frame, anamorphic, cinematic look.
And by full frame, though, you mean Academy full frame.
Anamorphic.
These days, people hear full frame and they think the still photography format, but no, the original full frame.
That's true. Like an LF, yes.
Exactly. No, we do. No, is a 35 millimeter frame.
I get a little confused because sometimes you can shoot anamorphic on a 35 mil center frame, but not all the lenses will cover very successfully. That I am going to take a guess that we stayed with the Academy center, but I'm not.
Rather than a comment,
swear to it. Anyway,
you'd know by the boom.
Anyway, that's exciting. Like, fantastic. You know, we're going to have. That's like my favorite. You know, film anamorphic.
It is the quintessential anamorphic format. It really is. Yeah, you know, and that is,
and it's the most cinematic look. If you're looking for cinematic, that's.
There you go.
I've done commercials that way for that very reason.
It's tough to beat that look. Yeah. So I usually don't go down this path, but I'm curious. Is it Panavision anamorphic? Which flavor of anamorphic?
No, we went. I've kind of over the years become. Lone Star was shot spherical, Super 35 widescreen on Panaflex cameras, Panavision Primo lenses, hence that beautiful, crisp, high contrast look that you referenced before. And so I've gone both ways. But in recent years, I felt like the newer generation of Arriflex film cameras, the LTST 235, 435 family, are just a little bit better. And I've also, since Amelia, mm-hmm. the Amelia Earhart biopic we did, been very fond of the Hawk anamorphic lenses out of Weiden in southern Germany. Got to know those guys over the years, and they've been great very helpful to me, and I'm very fond of the way their glass comes out. So we shot with the Class X Hawk lenses on Arriflex cameras. Interestingly enough, I did, because it's a TV show. I mean, it's a streaming show, but I did say, would you be interested in 3-perf anamorphic using 1.3 squeeze lenses, which Hawk also do great. And I've shot, I think Gifted was an example of a film I shot like that. Very
Those
low
Blue-light
budget film.
1.3s are great, great lenses. That 1.3 squeeze is.
It is. And we shot tests side by side. And at the end of the day, Jonas said, no, I just prefer the look of the 2x squeeze, and I'll sacrifice that extra 25% of running time. And bam, so there we are. So we stayed with that.
All right.
Yeah, and that, so that was the sort of shooting format and film.
Yeah.
God bless it, film.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, the show seems to have, I'm gonna say, three sort of main set piece areas. You've got sort of this flashback, sort of 1950s ultra futuristic modern sort of world. Then you've got the land of the wasteland. It's like, it's just nothing but desolate and decay, all over the place. And they've got sort of this third space, which is the vault dwellers who in some ways are almost still stuck in like 1950s America, and they're really, completely ignorant of the outside world. Did you try to adjust your formula or style for each of these different sort of these different areas? I mean, the whole thing's
I
rather
mean,
clean, but I definitely felt like 1950s America futurism has a little bit of a patina to it, has a little bit more of a style. So you tell me.
yeah, essentially it was more driven by art department and location than photography. I mean, the vault, by its nature, it's an artificial environment. It's lit entirely by artificial lighting. So, and because we wanted the flexibility to move the camera pretty much at will, from the earliest days of prep, I was working with the art department and the props department to make sure that the lighting units that we installed, and obviously with my gaffer as well, Bill Almeida, that the lighting units that were installed were actually providing enough ambient light for us to shoot film. As it was, we did push the film a stop for most of the vault scenes. This environment that looks and feels and is lit like a modern industrial space, or I wouldn't say a supermarket, that's a little unfair, but the concealed lighting, strip lighting, bulkhead lighting, that all is referenced in the game. And that, I think, is sort of, and then in the big space in the vault, the farm, the lighting varies with the time of day that the vault dwellers have elected to have. And you see it in full daytime, you see it at twilight, and you see it at night.
I'm assuming
So
it was a virtual stage. I'm
it
assuming
was a
that.
virtual stage, it's an LED stage. And so that's hilarious. So we're using the LED volume to create the illusion of an illusory space.
That's great.
As you said, because the vault dwellers are sort of stuck in this sort of atomic age 1950s, sort of, what would you call it, World's Fair technology, flying cars and everything's tubes, and that they that their illusion is created by an array of, I'm guessing, 65mm projectors. Think Cinerama on a full 180 sweep. And it's, I mean, it's not, we're actually seeing an LED wall, but that was what we were in the story. That's what it is. And so there's, that's a little bit, the lighting there is a little bit more varied, but the corridors and the rooms of the vault were very much, let's say, sort of interior artificial lit spaces, and we sort of were very rigorous about that. And the wasteland is primarily filmed in the Utah salt flats and the deserts of Namibia, with a few cobbled together bits and pieces upstate New York.
That was very much my question. It felt the wasteland feels so varied. It felt like to me like it must have been in multiple locations. Not, I mean, there you've got intersecting storylines of the wasteland.
Yeah.
You know, the Brotherhood of Steel and the vault dwellers coming out into the world. And you mentioned supermarket. You actually do have a supermarket set piece, I think, in the end.
We do have a supermarket. Yes.
Super duper.
Yes. Mark
with
super duper mark.
With the. Matt Berry voiced a robot that sort of floats around that wants to, you're not really sure what exactly the intentions are of the robot, because it kind of helps our protagonist early on, and then it wants to hurt her. That whole sequence to me is really very interesting. It's sort of it's fun, it's comical. I feel like it's sort of quintessential what the Fallout series is, sort of like what goes on right there. I personally love that whole sequence completely. Can you talk a little bit about the very practical real effects of that robot? Because, you know, there's got to be a VFX shot or two in there to sell the dream of it floating. But at the same time, it's that low-tech Star Wars, almost like lived-in wasteland sort of, you know, futuristic technology that's integrating with all of sort of the mundane, commonplace, you know, 1950s America here. How difficult was it to have your virtual robot puppet character on set with the other actor?
Super Duper Mart, which is this amazing, quite long scene in, I think, episode 4. Ella Purnell's character, Lucy, has been brought there by the ghoul, Walter Groggen, who wants to sell her to these guys, unbeknownst, she thinks, to sexual slavery, but it's worse than that. It's organ harvesting. And anyway, so there she's in this space. Well, we scouted it. We found this amazing abandoned supermarket in Staten Island. We scouted it. We planned it. Worked all the lighting plans out with my gaffer, Bill, and then... For all kinds of reasons, we passed that scene off to one of the series directors, Daniel Longino, and his DP, Teodoro Magnacci. Tio. And they did a great job of it. I mean, yes, we'd planned it, but they executed it, and they did I can't believe how much they achieved in a really compressed schedule. I think we gave them 3 days to shoot it, and there's so much going on with zombies and attacking and yeah, it's an amazing environment. And again, all fluorescent, you know, we carefully plotted out which fluorescent lights would work, which ones wouldn't, which ones would flicker, which ones would be a bit greener than others. Yeah, there was quite a lot of planning. I was quite disappointed not to get to shoot it. And on one level, in other levels, knowing how much work there was, quite relieved that somebody else took it on for us while we were shooting at the Brooklyn Army Terminal, doing the story about the doctor and his dog. The showrunners, Graham Wagner and Geneva Robertson-Wowett, who were also the key writers, working with Jonathan, who I think we would call the show's creator, but Geneva and Graham did all the heavy lifting of the actual writing and the show running. The show was sort of a fluid process even once we started shooting, they were still trying to refine and sort out some different story points as we went forward. So, I mean, but that in itself, I mean, I was intrigued watching the later episodes, just how significant that Cooper's backstory is in terms of explaining the whys and wherefores of the vault life and the ultimate destruction of attempts at rebuilding civilization on the surface, which was, I was, you know, I'd only actually read up to the end of episode 4. I had no idea what happened after that, partly because the scripts weren't fully completed at that point. Still works in progress. And I think it's really interesting the way that, you know, it was great for me to sit down recently and watch the whole season and go, is that why she, and, you know, like putting it all together, which, you know, as much as any fan would. So interesting.
I feel like the show, and I know, and by no way mean this disparagingly, it's like cotton candy. It's like, you know, it's like every, it's just like, it's every moment in this show, I feel like it just kind of like washes over me and I get so sucked into it. And it's kind of like ephemeral and I kind of then on to the next thing. But I went back and I watched some of the episodes again and I started like, it was interesting. I didn't realize how much I had missed the first time and just how sort of like delightful it is. It's filmmaking at the highest level. It's this sort of like grand, very you know, very similar to, I would say, sort of the scale and impact of, like, you know, Westworld and other Jonathan Nolan's Lisa Joy things in the past. But I know a season two was greenlit right away, but is there a moment in all of season one that or a shot in particular that you really like, that you, this might have been the most fun? I know that logistics wise, and you're talking about how it kind of all got, you know, reordered and put together. But when you were on set, was there a day you were like, this is the best day doing this? This is like, I'm really appreciating this. I'm really, you know, feeling the own internal gratification for what we're making on this day.
I mean, I really loved the location work in Namibia and Utah, but in terms of like just fun bravura filmmaking, the scene where these ne'er-do-wells come to dig up the ghoul and enlist him in some nefarious project of theirs, which he won't have a bar of, in the graveyard in God knows where, which we shot in this old Civil War era fort in Queens. And, you know, the art department had created the graveyard to go with it. And it's classic sort of horror movie, you know, almost 1950s horror movie stuff. And it's, I don't know, it was just so much fun to prep, and it's lit with flames and, you know, spooky backlights, moonlights, and, you know, it's,
yeah,
really,
it's the introduction of my faves. Walter Goggins' ghoul character.
It is. Oh, yeah. And it's his intro.
He ends up being like, you know, this you know, pivotal character that kind of takes us through, and he's the only one who spans the generations, which is
really, I know, cool. And he survives the end, so I'll bet you he'll be there in season two.
I bet with
more to reveal, you know, because there's still stories, there's still secrets to be uncovered for sure.
Well, Stuart, this has been really great. I'm so glad that we got to talk about your career and dive into Fallout. But let me ask you, occasionally, you know, some of the DPs, a small portion of them, do like social media or out there in the world. Is there a place that people who are fans of this, if they want to read it, chat to you? Do you do any of the Instagrams or the Twitters or things?
I definitely have an Instagram account, which I think I'm searchable as Stuart Dryberg. Which is mostly, you won't find a lot of film news on it, partly because we are constrained as members of the crew.
Absolutely.
Against, you know, there are certain people who are allowed to publish on social media, but it's, you know, the studios and the streaming services like to keep it pretty controlled. You can chase me up on Instagram if you like. I don't necessarily see all the messages, and I don't necessarily respond to all of them, but sometimes I do.
I understand. Well, we'll put a link over in the show notes over at camnoir.com. Stuart, this was so much fun. I'm so glad that you could take some time to come on the show today. Thanks so much.
Ilya, it's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been really fun.
Thanks for being on the Cinematography Podcast. I can't wait to see what you do next. I'd love to have you back sometime to chat about it.
You never know. I don't know. I have no idea what I'm doing next. I've completed a been back in the world of rom-coms recently with Amy Schumer on Kind of Pregnant, here in Brooklyn at home every night. Marvelous. What's next? Who knows? It's a big world.
Stuart, that was great. Thanks so much for your time, and I can't wait to see Fallout season two. All right, so that was Stuart Dryberg. Hey, Stuart, it was so great chatting with you. What a fantastic conversation. I'm really looking forward to seeing what you do next.
Exactly the kind of person I always want on the show. It's so exciting to have him on.
Yeah. So Ben, you'll never guess what time it is.
Well, we're doing this one in the morning, so I'm going to go with 8:58.
You're exactly right. But it's also time to pay the bills. So we got to thank our fine friends over at Aputure, makers of really incredible and often very affordable high-performance LED lights for the entertainment industry. And they have a new version of, I would say, one of their flagship lights, possibly one of the most popular lights they've ever made. And that is called the LS600C Pro 2. Just rolls off the tongue. But the LS600C Pro 2 is an update to the LS600C, which is a 600-watt, extremely powerful RGB WW, which means it does two flavors of white and all flavors of color. And that white essentially is either ends of a spectrum, and they can combine and mix all these different colors to create a rainbow of white values and very highly saturated party colors. But the thing that's cool about the 600C Pro 2 is that it's extremely bright. The old one, which was still incredible, this one is like 30-35% brighter. And it's essentially the same cost. So if you were thinking about getting the old version, there's now a new version that packs more punch into the same space for essentially the same money. Of course, Aputure products are available over at Hot Rod Cameras, and they actually...
Wait a minute.
I know. It's crazy. You wouldn't imagine.
But yes, wait, you can get your Hot Rod Cameras.
I am. There's you see the self-serving nature of this ad then too. Not only do I talk about Aputure, but I'd say you can go buy it. There's other places you can buy it too, but if you like this podcast, maybe you want to buy it from Hot Rod Cameras. It helps keep the podcast going. Especially during these like really, really weird days that the entire industry is in. So, hey, if you have been thinking about lights, cameras, lenses, anything out there, you know, of course, Hot Rod Cameras is a place you can go buy it, but especially go to buy your Aputure stuff. Things like the new LS600C Pro 2 would be wonderful for your kit and will help you make really fantastic pictures. So, yeah, thanks so much to Aputure for sponsoring this show.
And now, Short Ends.
So, Ben, it is our Short End time where we discuss our pet obsessions of the week. Do you have something that you are obsessed about this week?
Well, last week for the 4th of July, I went to Florida to visit my dad. Mm. And part of my visit to Florida was to the Enzian Theater, which is the art house theater in Maitland, Florida, where I met my wife, and they are dependent on arts funding to a certain degree. And there was a big article last week that, and I don't mean to get political, and I'm really not trying to be partisan, but this kind of thing really, really, really chafes me, that the governor of Florida vetoed, so it was already a law, it had already been passed, vetoed millions in Florida arts funding. And it's they're saying it's going to disproportionately impact queer and BIPOC organizations, but it's hitting everybody. It's hitting the Orlando Symphony Orchestra. It's hitting all of these arts organizations, and I find it endlessly frustrating that that arts organizations are the target, especially when if you look at what our money goes to. I mean, how much of it goes to sports stadiums and things like that, that are also fully capitalistic enterprises. We wouldn't be doing this podcast if we didn't think arts was important. And arts has an importance above and beyond the capital money it brings in, you know. And I feel like when we start getting rid of arts in our country, and you know, for our international listeners, I'm sorry to hit you with local American politics, and even for those of you not in Florida, I'm not in Florida, I'm in California. I just think it ruins our culture, you know. And you know, nothing would make me more sad to see the Enzian go away. And I guess, you know, bringing up Blair Witch about that, like, again, I could go on a long tear and explain to you why the Blair Witch Project never would have existed without the Enzian, and how the Enzian played important parts in every part of that movie getting funded by by the people who made money off of it. I just I don't know. We're not a political podcast. We're not here to talk about like hard news, but it just kind of breaks my heart that one guy with flick of a pen can destroy the arts in an entire state, in a state as big as Florida, you know. And it leads me to realize just kind of how vulnerable it all is, because even here in California, there have been some laws that have screwed up a lot of the arts a little bit, like theater. Like it's harder to make theater in California than it used to be. It's just frustrating. So I guess my short end is arts funding, but really like a great deal of frustration with what's going on in my my home state, the place I came from, and how they're kind of gutting the things that I think made the place great. You know, like I'm not like down on you if you like watching sports. I don't watch sports, but watch all the sports you want. I'm not here to say that you're a lousy person, but I do think that if you're someone who's like, of course we need to build a stadium, well, I feel like of course you need to fund your symphony orchestra. Of course you need to, you know, the arts that your community wants are important to that community, and it's part of the identity of that community, and it's going to be a real shame to see it go away.
Amen. It feels very fragile and tenuous a lot of the time. We don't have arts enshrined in our constitution.
Nor do we have sports, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the type of thing that could easily go away tomorrow in the event of national emergencies and all kinds of other things too, but it could vary. It's almost, for certain groups of people out there, they look at arts funding as the first thing on the chopping block. What we can get rid of to balance the budget? Oh, let's get rid of the arts. We are so much richer of a nation by having diverse and large amounts of art. I don't like all the art that's created out there, but I certainly want it to exist. I certainly want people to have the opportunity to do it. And if there isn't some sort of public funding for it, it makes it a hell of a lot harder, especially considering it only takes really small percentages of your tax dollar to actually fund a lot of art.
It's a drop in the bucket.
It really is.
And it's frustrating because, like, look at any culture that you've ever studied, you know, ancient Greece, ancient Rome. Whatever.
What survives?
What do you study? What do you know about them? Yeah. You know about their art and their philosophy, right?
That's exactly
right. You might know about their religion, and you might know about their architecture, but that's because it's part of their art. And it's not like, you know, you will know. I will never know. I mean, maybe somebody knows how balanced the books were in ancient Rome. Like, did Caligula, did he keep the trains running on time?
Marcus Aurelius. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, what was their fiscal policy? You're not going to know that. And I understand you do have to balance the books, but I also feel like there are, I don't know. I mean, I guess the thing about the world is that, like, I would look at certain things that are, that are canonized and untouchable by, you know, by the tax code and say, like, why don't you tax that? And you know, I would be clapped back with 1,000 reasons why not to. And it's because I have different priorities. But I do think that as a culture, you know, arts funding should be a big part of our priority. And, you know, I feel like a lot of the, you know, like when you go to, you know, Canada or England or whatever, like they even finance films. The state does.
Absolutely,
And it creates its own horrifying bureaucracy. I've talked to people who have to deal with it.
Yeah.
But it's like, but that's an option. If you're someone who has a story to tell, you can jump through certain hoops and get it made without having to go appeal to a bunch of money people.
Yeah, potentially. And there's people who say that the government shouldn't be involved in stuff like that. But I have a tendency to disagree, because I actually think that's sort of what makes life worth living. That's the kind of what, you know, enriches everybody's lives. There's something, transcendent about a story or a piece of music or about almost any sort of thing that you can experience that has an emotional effect on you. And that's what good art does. Good art has emotional effect on the person who is consuming it, on the viewer, on, you know, the people who are standing in the same room. So, you know, if if it's possible that that we increase arts funding in this country, I think we could definitely use it, because boy, there's you know, there's actually not that many artists out there, not that many people out there, and the people who are doing it, there's always a pretty major struggle to make sure that their art actually reaches the world. So anyway. Hopefully, I'm sorry to hear about the Enzian. I hope that.
I think the Enzian's going to be okay, but they're just having a budget shortfall.
Yeah, well, I mean, they got to make up for that somehow. So who knows? Maybe it'll be a mid-roll commercial now in Citizen Kane. I don't know what they're going to do.
I hope not. I don't know.
I hope not either. So I was just trying to think of the worst.
See the grimace that I made when you said that.
Just trying to think of the most, you know, horrible thing that a theater could possibly
do. Yeah, in the middle of, it'd be like a podcast in the middle of Citizen Kane, like stamps.com will have an ad. Like, and we'll have like an AI reading in Orson Welles' voice.
Yeah, I was going to say it would be, it'd be State Farm. So, you know, it'd be something, it would be very loud. And it would be Arnold Schwarzenegger saying, "Neba." And it would be I say that because it's very timely right now. I can't turn on Hulu without seeing six ads for State Farm with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Anyway. Yeah, that is something about streaming service ads. Like, yeah, there's not that many of them. And if you watch a service now that has ads, you see the same one a lot.
It's true. Anyway, so Ilya, what is your, what are you all about this week?
Well, I'm not sure if we mentioned it on the show already, but the union, IATSE, has a tentative agreement, which is a pretty big deal, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it means we're not going to have a strike, hopefully.
Hopefully. I mean, there's no guarantees yet, but it's looking pretty good. The 13 unions that are part of IATSE, which of course includes the Camera Guild, you know, sort of my people, they're looking at a 14.5% salary hike over the next 3 years, half of it coming in the first year, which is great. They're looking at protections against AI, including like things that you can't be fired or pressured into using your likeness for some sort of bit or purpose.
I was about to say, there goes my AI grip that I've been building. But yeah.
Yes. There's also, AI seems to definitely be a big part of this, but it really sort of classifies the
idea. You can't spell AI without IA.
Without the letters I and A. Yes, that's true. But there is other protections there too, saying that AI would be considered to be a tool and not as a human replacement and things like that. So while there's some people who have been critical that there is not spelling out of like complete AI ban, it sounds like it's actually a very sanguine and mature usage of AI and classifying it very much as a tool and not as a way
I'm
to replace
I'm dead serious
people,
when I ask, so. What was IATSE's fear about AI? What can AI do? Like,
I think it's
autofocus. What can it do?
I think it is the same fear that here. I heard something actually really interesting yesterday that I hopefully appreciate. But there's a lot of people talking about the impact of AI on our society and culture right now. And the number one place that I think anyone can see that is the stock market. The stock market has gone crazy because of a few AI stocks. NVIDIA being one of them. But in a very recent analysis of the S&P 500, when you remove the few companies that are AI-based companies, which are making the stock market completely go crazy right now, we're actually in a 2% decline. We're actually in a 2% deficit over the last 6 months. So it's really just a handful of stocks that is completely sort of like bolstering the financial world. And there's a lot of people who are heavily invested in this. They think it's going to, you know, be the be-all, end-all. And that permeates all the way through, I would say, our world, including our industry, because it is a buzzword that people are talking about in all facets. Oh, your new AI-enhanced television. Oh, this new AI-enhanced advertisement. Oh, this AI-enhanced McDonald's experience. Whatever the F it is that you're into right now, there is some sort of people talking about how AI is going to have some sort of impact on that.
But if you're now, IATSE, like, what does AI do for IATSE?
Well,
is like,
editors in particular. I would say people who work in post-production, there's quite a bit of concerns about the, I want to say like, you know, replacement of assistants. I want to say that there is definitely some concerns about people who are involved in technology in one way or another being usurped or replaced. And
like DITs or something? I mean, you still need someone to do it.
You do, but at least they're putting up some very basic guardrails that says we're not going to be using it as a methodology just to put people out of work. That's fair. I think that's important.
I mean, I'm glad that they're doing that. I just kind of feel like IATSE are the people who like pick up pieces of gear and set them up and tear them down and put them on a truck and, you know, or pick up items for the art department and set them out and put them away and return them to rental houses and stuff. Like, I don't know how any of those jobs, you know, you're holding a boom mic and following an actor. AI isn't going to do that better than you at any time until you can build a robot that can do that.
I disagree. I think they might make an AI enhanced perambulator, which is essentially a big machine that controls a boom. And there are all kinds of things that people are looking to try to disrupt right now. And they're trying to use the technology of large language models and machine learning to get rid of jobs. There's a concerted effort on Wall Street to find disruptions using AI, and IATSE
basically said, so if they're successful and they get rid of jobs, then who's going to buy their shit?
There is a lot. There's very much an Ouroboros, you know, eating of its tail here. That I think. And here, the good news is that most of them are going to fail. I mean, if you look at any sort of fad or thing, most of them fail. A couple of big ones survive. They buy up smaller companies. Other ones fade into the background. It is not going to be the immediate disruption that so many people think because there's a couple of good party tricks. So we'll see.
I think it's the new crypto. The more I look at it, and as you know, I'm not afraid of AI. I goof around with it all the time. We talk about Michael Cioni and what he's doing with Strata. I have great reverence for what AI can do as a tool. But people who are believing that it's going to just replace everything, and including people who believe it will replace all movies, we're just going to watch AI-generated content. There's the word. Yeah. You know, to me, it's like, okay, this is exactly how everyone was talking about crypto 5 years ago.
And a good party trick now doesn't actually mean in 5, 10, or even 50 years that it has the same impact and effect on people that the way you get from, it's a very deep and wide uncanny valley. You do not get to cross that easily, and not in the way that you think. You just type a few sentences into a prompt, you create a prompt, type it into a system, and then all of a sudden it spits back what it is that you're hoping for. The process to get there is probably somewhere in the nature of 50 to 100 years. So get, you know, everyone needs to chill the F out. They need to chill out.
It's, I agree. Long, I mean, I'm not saying IATSE needs to chill out or any of the unions need to chill out.
No, I'm talking about the fanboys for AI who are telling everyone that, you know, no one's going to have to work anymore because a robot and, you know, a self-driving car and everything. There's a great video circling the internet right now of a cop pulling over a self-driving car that turned the wrong way down a one-way street. And then the cop has to talk to a human who's not driving the car, who then just makes a report. But the cop's like, who do I give this ticket to? How do I give this ticket? There's a bunch of crap in our quick rush to this, you know, modern sci-fi world that we're trying to get to, that, you know, things have to be worked out, including like what happens when a self-driving car creates a major, major incident like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Actually, I'm pretty sure it was in Florida. I think it was Florida. I'm not exactly sure where it was now, but
might have been. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, the reason that I obviously support the unions regardless of all this, but the reason I think that they are right is to get this enshrined in the contract is not because I think you can make a robot that replaces a boom op very easily or cheaply, or that it would be less expensive or less hassle than having a person there.
One thing is for sure, this will not be boring. There is going to be plenty of people talking about this coming into, the coming years. But what I can say with some certainty is that, the appetites for what people like is not changing. And no one is suddenly going to decide that just watching, quasi Uncanny Valley animated video game characters having conversations is going to replace what people like to see. And I think that there's some people out there who think that that is very much coming and happening. And I would say it's only happening in the same way that animation is a thing right now. And it does not replace the stuff that people want to see a lot of, which includes sports, live events, you know, drama, comedy, horror, all of that type of stuff. AI doesn't do all that.
But AI doesn't give you any human experience.
It doesn't.
At all.
So, yeah.
It gives you something funky and weird and sometimes remixed in hilarious, weird ways. But like, yeah.
I think that people get hung up on the novelty of what it is that they're seeing and how it was created and not necessarily thinking about extrapolating that into what it is that they want
to
see.
Yeah. And so I think being able to pass the Turing test doesn't mean you want it to be your roommate.
Exactly correct. So Ben, that is going to do it for this week. We got to thank some people, including someone new. So we got to say a fond farewell to Ben Katz. Ben Katz, thank you so much.
Our longtime suffering editor.
Yeah, who did a fantastic job cutting out our uhs and ums and making us not sound completely moronic. We got to welcome Michael Dispenza, our new editor of this podcast.
Hello, Michael.
Michael actually got his feet wet a little bit last week cutting together our host wraps, but this is going to be his first full episode. So, hey, welcome, Michael. Hopefully we didn't make it too hard for you. Hopefully, a little bit. There's a couple of cuts. Hey, my camera didn't overheat once, which is way better than my interview with Stuart where it overheated like five times. So yeah, he's probably cursing me a little bit because of that.
I have a little bit of a cough, and at one point my six-year-old son ran into the room and got on camera.
Yeah, for the most part, I think that we weren't absolutely horrendous this week. I think we did an okay job. Hey, and we got to thank our stalwarts, our people who come back every single week to make sure that we are doing things and getting it done. And by those people, I mean Alana Cody. Alana
Big Cody, time.
Who yeah,
always,
who's
always.
Producing the show and making
couldn't do
it
without her.
And of course, we also have to thank Kay Zalatracci, who basically composed music for us like, 10 years ago? And then came back and composed a little bit more. He's got more thank yous per, I want to say, hour of work than anyone on the show. Kay's, thank you very much again. We are going to keep thanking you forever. Thank you for that music.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah, he just played a new piece of music for me yesterday that I loved.
Oh, all right. Is it appropriate for the show? Can we steal it?
Let's talk about it.
All right, great. All right, so Ben, where can people find you if they want to find you outside of the Cinepod?
Go to bedrock.com, benrock.com. Sound like I said bedrock, not bedrock, benrock.com. I am not from the Flintstones.
I wonder what bedrock.com is. Let me take a look.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to know. You can check me out there. You can find me on social media. I had a bunch of people connecting me on LinkedIn. Go for it. Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, etc.
Well, to answer your question, there is a phone number and it says info at Bedrock and there's a logo of a big building. It doesn't say what it is. So there you go.
All right. Well, they have an office, whoever they are, or they acquired a stock photo of an office. Where can people find you?
They can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, currently operating out of Burbank, California, and very soon, Portland, Oregon. In a few weeks, we'll start having some regular hours. So Hot Rod Cameras, that's where you can buy all kinds of camera gear, and you can find me.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you want to sign us out?
That's a wrap.
Oof.
Ooh, that was cheesy. I can't do it. Yeah, we need something different. I don't know. You take us out. You try it.
That's a wrap. I don't know. Shit. It's cheesy.
You have to do it. You have to do it every week because I think that was better than me.
I have to do it every week.
All right. I'm going to hit cut now. There's just no polite way to sign us off gracefully. It's an awkward ending every week.
Signing off.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.